Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Scoop. It is Monday, September 29th. It's our final Monday in September, and we are finishing off an already really busy news month with more breaking news and developing stories. And I'm so glad we're here together to work through it all. We're going to start with some of the tougher news of the week that is a developing story just from Sunday, from the last 24 hours, which is a shooting at a Michigan church. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because there are parts of that investigation that are being announced that strike me as slightly unusual from other announcements. And I want to point that out to you. Before we get to that, we also have some breaking news out of Washington, D.C. We're curious about a potential government shutdown. We've talked about that for the last several weeks, but now here we are at the deadline. We have a lot of these stories are percolating. Each one of them could eventually be the story of the week. So we'll work through it all. Before I get to that, though, I want to actually take you to the National Archives. We're just going to sort of set the stage a little bit here, do something a little bit different as we like to do at Smarter News. And I want to show you something for those of you watching on our YouTube channel, and I'll include it in our notes for those of you listening on podcasts. We appreciate all of you, how you're tuning in anytime you can, and whatever works for you works for us. What I'm showing you is something that I saw for the very first time in person. So inside the National Archives, which is actually one of the more modern buildings in Washington, D.C., which is ironic, isn't it? Because you think of the National Archives, like the National Archives, all the historic documents, is in a fairly new building, all things considered. It was built in the 1930s, and really everything started to be more or less organized there, more distinctly, with more purpose after World War II. So I was in D.C. reporting on a few different stories. I had an interview with the head of the FDA, Dr. Marty McCarry, last Thursday. So I was in D.C. doing a little bit of work and trying to do a few interviews on the side as well, because you know how much we appreciate history at Smarter News. And without history, our headlines have no context. So I had this thought, like, let's go into the National Archives. And the reason for that was because there's an exhibit there that is the first time we've ever seen this particular exhibit before. It is the full display of the entire U.S. Constitution. So if you go into the National Archives, often you will see the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution, the four pages, original pages. But you may not see all the amendments. And you won't see this fifth page, which is like a cover letter of sorts that was put on the Constitution. So it's a very fascinating story. And I was able to speak to the historian there in the National Archives. That's an upcoming interview that I'm going to share with you as well. But in this room, this rotunda at the National Archives, there's this amazing mural around this area where all these important documents are stored. And it's a mural done by a man by the name of Barry Faulkner. And you see, when you look up, some very familiar faces. Like, you're able to see, oh, there's, you know, President Washington. There's Thomas Jefferson. There's Benjamin Franklin. But then there's a whole bunch of other people that you have no idea who they are. And as I was looking at the Declaration of Independence, and by the way, the mural is the founders, you know, those that signed the Declaration of Independence, those that signed the Constitution. Those are the folks that are looking over this room. Makes sense, doesn't it? So as I'm looking up and I'm seeing those familiar faces, but then seeing all these other people that I don't recognize, and I'm looking at their signatures, again, some I see very clearly. Alexander Hamilton, he had great handwriting. Very clear. Other people, you're like, who was that person? Turns out Barry Faulkner had a very interesting quote because he struggled with this. We have that thought that we have some images about what the founders look like. Probably a lot of that's determined by pop culture. You know, I think of General Washington based on some of the statues of him and President Washington that way. John Adams, I probably think about him the way the HBO series had him. Same with Thomas Jefferson. Alexander Hamilton, I think about the Broadway musical, but I can think of something. Something comes to mind. But there's a whole bunch of people that were part of the founding of this country that I don't know. And Barry Faulkner, the artist, really struggled with this because he didn't have a picture. It's not like they had Instagram. They weren't drawing self-portraits and saving them. You know, there was sometimes he didn't have anything to go on. And one of the quotes that he has in the way he was describing his work, and I'm paraphrasing here, is he said something to the effect of their mothers would not even recognize them because he was just trying to create what he could based on what he had. But he made, you know, didn't know their hairstyle. He didn't know what they liked to wear. He didn't know how much they weighed, you know, what was someone's height in relation to Benjamin Franklin. And so it was a really interesting part of history to see that created around our foundational documents, because it sort of brought up that saying, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? You know, if these people were around, but no one knows their names and can't recognize them, do they matter to the foundation of America? And to me, of course, the answer is yes. Yes, all of them matter. They all mattered. And they probably all played a role. Some were likely more quiet than others. But who knows if, like, there was a conversation on the street corner with, you know, between Thomas Jefferson and a guy that we don't know his name that helped open a line of thinking or communication that led to compromise. It really made me realize how much we know about history and how little, and how difficult it is to determine, you know, who actually becomes a legend, who actually becomes an icon, and who sort of fades into history. And maybe by choice too. We're not sure everybody wanted to be recognized all the time. There was a price to pay for that. Different celebrity culture, but definitely a price to pay. You know, if the British were looking for somebody, they probably were looking by somebody that they knew by name and they could recognize, not some of the other folks that maybe could fade into the public. I'm going to show you one more quick thing, and we'll see for those of you watching live, our insiders. And again, for those of you on podcast, I'm going to put this in so you can look for it. It's kind of a fun game. So if you look at the founders, they're all together. They're sort of staged almost as Greek figures. You know, it's sort of like you would see in different paintings from the past. But there's clouds behind them. There's a tree and there's a cloud behind what is Thomas Jefferson when you're closer to it, because you could recognize him because he has a red hue to his hair. And what it supposedly looks like is Abraham Lincoln's face, his profile, laying down. So the cloud that's pointing up towards the sky, it's kind of a darker cloud. It's supposed to have the profile of Abraham Lincoln in it. That's what's said about it. I'll see if you could see it. So more on this interview coming up, but just a reminder that sometimes in this culture that we're all, there seems to be so many folks trying to make their mark, you know, with the use of media and otherwise, we don't always get to choose who becomes the voice and a face of a generation. But that doesn't mean that the rest of us don't matter, that we're part of the American experiment too. And we have a role too. Of course, of course. So seems like future painters aren't going to have that much of a problem because our images are all over the place. So unless you're not on social media at all, but it would be much easier for it to find images of all of us at this point. And I think about that, and I'm very grateful that social media did not exist through my awkward years. Although I'm sure I could find some very good photos. And by awkward years, I think about even my first few years on television. So more on this trip to DC. I want to touch on it a little bit, including the announcement that came after Scoop last week. That was an announcement that was underscoring an association, perceived association by some, of Tylenol usage and autism. I didn't know that announcement was coming on Monday. I knew I had the interview on the books on Thursday, so that was part of our conversation. So I want to get to that in just a moment. And we're going to be kind of all focused on DC for a little bit of this broadcast because I want to organize some of the news that's out there for you. Before I get to that, though, I do want to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in Michigan. And in fact, we had a live update just a few minutes ago. What we heard about this attack was very simple. Someone drove up to the church, started to open fire, but then there was some sort of fire ignited as well. And that this fire was burning fairly aggressively and was a whole other dynamic to this story. So early reports were suggesting that law enforcement confronted the shooter. We know that to be true. The shooter is killed. And we know that there's several other people that were also killed in this exchange of fire. And then there was also a question about whether or not the fire that took place, the flames in the church, led to other deaths, which later on Sunday night we learned to be the case. So let me play a little bit of sound here from the press conference last night from different law enforcement officials. So who's speaking? You're going to hear a few different voices. There, you know, some from local law enforcement, some from the FBI, some from the state police. But there's parts of this that are curious to me, and I want you to listen to it.
There's a couple additional bodies that we've discovered in the church. So that makes our total victim count up to 4 victims. As I said before, there has already been the suspect who is deceased as well. So we have 5 deceased persons from this tragic incident. I'd also like to acknowledge the heroism of not only the first responders, but the people who were inside that church at the time. They were shielding the children who were also present within the church, moving them to safety. Just hundreds of people just practicing their faith, just extreme courage, brave, and that's the type of community that we are.
I wanted to include that because even though that's not the soundbite you're going to hear across all other networks, this matters. And understanding the community that's impacted. And I wanted to make sure that that was flagged. And I'm very grateful to our colleague, Stephanie, who was able to grab that for us. Here's the FBI speaking now.
I can confirm at this time that the FBI is now leading the investigation and is investigating this as an act of targeted violence.
The Michigan State Police continues to respond to several locations throughout the community as we receive additional bomb threats at other locations.
The entire church has not been cleared because it's a total loss due to the fire. So these first responders right now, they're in recovery mode. They're trying to fight through all the debris. No, I don't know how many people are unaccounted for at this time. We do know that there are some that are unaccounted for.
How did the fire start?
This is ATF.
For this incident, the fire started basically as a suspect. All indications on this investigation are the suspect used an accelerant of some sort, we believe gasoline, and lit the church on fire.
Was it an IED that he may have used?
There are, at this point, I'm not going to comment on IEDs. I will confirm that there were some suspected explosive devices that were located. But as far as using them to initiate the blaze, I can't say that. This scene is actively being investigated by ATF. Most people don't know that ATF is the federal arson police, and we have a team from across the country coming in, our national response team. It is a cadre of expert fire investigators that are coming here from across the country to investigate this scene and get to the cause or the origin and cause of this fire.
Is there at least one other report that a local church was searched by the bomb squad?
We've searched multiple churches this evening for bomb threat protocol, yes.
Is that based on actual threats?
Yes. We received 911 calls about bomb threats or other indications that there was a bomb at a different location. Some of them were churches, and we've responded and cleared those locations.
So I know that was a little hard to hear there. There was a question about whether or not all the churches that were receiving threats were also the same type of church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You know, was there a pattern here? So this is what stands out most to me now with this update that we received at night, and then the subsequent update that we just received a few minutes ago. We'll likely have more maybe by the time that you hear this podcast, but what stands out is this reoccurring theme by law enforcement that continues about if you see something, say something. There's always signs at a community. These threats came after this attack. This is not threats before the attack happened that's maybe all attached to one person. So there's a question here about, well, motive, still working through that. And also, is there some other person, group? What exactly are officials looking at here? What exactly are they tracking? That seems to be, because they're reiterating that, this seems to be important to this story, and I don't know where it goes from here, but that's not typical. You know, we would have law enforcement say, you know, if anyone has known this person, you know, we're taking lead, all of that, that's normal. But this this threat for other locations, other churches, maybe not the same churches, maybe not all churches, maybe other public places. So what is this exactly about? And that seems to be an unanswered question right now. I want to show you one more thing because of the church that was targeted. I feel like this is important that you might see a lot in the news. So what I'm showing here on your screen is a lot of different headlines. So for example, The Guardian says Mormon church shooting suspect had Trump sign outside home, record show. Or what do we know about the suspect in the Michigan church shooting? You see different commentary on the type of church, you know, and I can see how for anyone looking at these headlines, are they all talking about the same church? You know, is it, what church are we talking about here? And I actually relied on one of our coworkers here, who's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, about this particular issue, because for several years, depending on who you are in the media and how you handle talking about this church, you may hear different titles, and you may hear it also in local commercials or broadcasts or advertisements. So the official title of this church, the church that this belonged to, is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Sometimes it's referred to as the Church of Latter-day Saints. It may be referred to as a Mormon church. The preferred title for the church is the full title. And for many, that's because those that practice this religion want to link it to Jesus Christ specifically and say that it falls under the umbrella of Christianity. There are those that will debate that. As we know, there's a lot of debates that happen in religion, and we'll probably not be able to solve that debate today. But because you may see these different terms used to describe this church, I thought it was helpful to learn a little bit about that and just know there's a lot of different umbrella terms. We're going to go with the official one, which is typically what we do. If the majority of a group want to be referred to in a certain way, I'll defer to that. There's no, that's a very easy editorial call. It's a show of respect. It doesn't affect necessarily the editorial of the story. I just want to be clear what church this belonged to, this particular property, and it was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In a church like this, I also learned something that you may hear of a temple, or you may hear of a church or meeting houses. So in this particular piece of property, it seemed to be a church where you have a lot of potentially different congregations meet. And every Sunday, their services will last about 2 hours. So you may have one group come in for a 2-hour time period to the same property, and another group come in for a 2-hour time period at that same property. And so it is going to be an active piece of property as other churches would be on a Sunday. What was interesting, and again, my coworker shared this with me, she said that next week there's actually a big meeting of the church that takes place every April and every October. And during these weekend meetings where there's a global broadcast about the church, typically a family may stay home and watch those on television. It's like, you know, maybe a 2-day event. It could be Saturday and Sunday, different talks that you could dip into. So you may not be on the property. And she said that was one of the things that really stood out to her, is thinking about, oh, if it was just next weekend, this property may not have a lot of people on it on a Sunday, but it was this Sunday and it was particularly full. Also, we had news from that church over the weekend that the leader of the church, who's referred to as the prophet, but has a title as president. So again, if you're unfamiliar with this, as I was, I thought it was interesting to learn. President Russell M. Nelson was the leader of the church, and he just passed away on Saturday. So the church was recognizing that passing, and then we have this big event. There's nothing to suggest that these two things are tied together, as we're still figuring out the suspect, the motive. There's been an identified suspect, but as you know, we don't repeat the name of a shooter or a suspect. We don't want to elevate them over the victims. We don't have victim names right now, to my knowledge. So this is still very much an ongoing investigation, and unfortunately, a lot more questions than answers, as is the case for something like this. But I just wanted to clarify a little bit of what you might see in the media, if that's helpful to you at all. It was certainly helpful to me, as I'm unfamiliar with that particular group. So more as we get it. And you know, there's several questions we can continue to ask about security. We're talking a lot about security on college campuses, security at live speaking events, also security at churches. And so more on this, as I mentioned, as we get it. I'm going to take you from Michigan as we continue to watch that story. We know the FBI is involved, and that means there's federal law enforcement on the ground as well as local. We're going to focus now just back on Washington, D.C. and what's happening there, because we have a couple big stories to watch this week. One has to do with the government shutdown, and there's a little bit of a healthcare connection to that as well that we can work through. So let's just talk a little bit about the government shutdown, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about this interview that I had with the FDA. So this government shutdown could potentially happen on Wednesday. What are we talking about here? We've had all these different bills passed that are these sort of temporary band-aids for government funding. We're going to fund the government for a couple months. We're going to kick the can down the road, and then we're going to have a conversation in September. Well, guess what? September is here, and we have to have this conversation again. What seems to be on the table for Republicans, and what is on the table, according to the Speaker of the House, is a continuing resolution. So when you hear that, you just think Band-Aid. Okay, continuing resolution. We're going to continue the current funding levels for another couple weeks because we want to negotiate further on a particular issue. So this gets us away from a shutdown. Nothing really changes per se, but this is a problem for Democrats because Democrats are very worried about some healthcare funding running out by the end of the year. There's an expiration at the end of the year for some funding related to government healthcare. And the concern is that without that funding, then prices will go up for some Americans. So this is a big priority and concern for some Democrats, and they want to solve that issue. They don't want to kick the can to November or another date before the end of the year when Thanksgiving is looming and everyone wants to go home for the holidays. They want some promise or assurance that some of that funding will be extended past the end of the year. Republicans are not indicating that that's what they're willing to do. They've so far drawn a pretty hard line in the sand about just saying, hey, let's just continue the funding at regular levels. So I have the vice president speaking about this. Remember, the vice president will serve as the president of the Senate. So his voice and his vote can be relevant depending on vote counts. And then you're going to hear from Senator Schumer, who is the highest ranking Democrat in the Senate as well. The House has already passed this. The House has basically said, our work is done. We passed a continuing resolution because there was enough votes from Republicans to push that through. But now it's a question of what is the Senate going to do with this? So I just want you to hear from both of these voices so you get a taste of what either side is saying.
Well, look, we don't want to shut down the government, Martha, but it's really up to the Democrats. Under our system, you need 60 Senate Democrats to vote for the clean continuing resolution that the President and House Republicans have put forward. I think it's preposterous, Martha, and I think the American people really should pay attention to the fact that Democrats are threatening to shut down the entire government because they want to give hundreds of billions of dollars of health care benefits to illegal aliens. I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen a political party actually advertising the fact that they want to shut down every essential function of government, and they want to use that as leverage so that they get more money for illegal alien health care benefits. It's such a stark contrast between Republicans who are trying to put the interests of the American people first and Democrats who I think would want to take money from the American people to give benefits to illegal aliens. We don't want to shut down the government, but if Democrats refuse to just pass this clean continuing resolution, that's exactly what's going to happen. And I think the Democrats are going to bear the responsibility for it.
The bottom line is very simple, Kristen. It's up to them. We have two concerns. The first is health care. Our health care situation is a shambles, in good part because of what the Republicans did in the BBB, their so-called big, beautiful bill. Now they want to change the name of it because they know it's not very popular. I think 68% of Americans don't like it. And so it's a mess. We're representing the people. Everywhere I go and my colleagues go throughout the country, red, blue, purple, people are saying, oh my God, you got to change this. People are losing their jobs. Rural hospitals are closing. People are going to get notices of $4,000 a year increase in their premiums. So our job is to represent the people of America. So far, they've stonewalled and said, we're not discussing any of that.
So they agree on one thing. It's the other side's responsibility. And we'll see how that works out. There's supposed to be a meeting today at the White House. The president has invited some of the Democrats to be at the White House. In the past, those meetings have been contentious and maybe not productive, depending on how you look at it. But who knows? They get face to face. Maybe they figure out a couple things that allow both sides to take some cover and pass something to at least prevent a shutdown for now. That said, these stories, some of you will ask me, well, what do you think is going to happen? In these stories, you never know. It's really a 50-50 chance that we could see a shutdown. If we see a shutdown, it's a temporary, you could see temporary furloughs of employees. It depends on how it's done, who it affects, and what the fallout is in the immediate. So unfortunately, I don't have much more to offer than that, is to watch the meeting that's going to take place in the afternoon on Monday and to see, you know, what actually is done in Washington, D.C. this week. More as we get it. But for right now, this, I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S. and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. This is where both sides sit today. And politics comes into play here. This is a very different calculation than next year at the same time. Next year at this time, we're going to be right before the midterm elections. And that's when you're going to see lawmakers break with their parties or start acting in a way that's more self-serving because they're worried about their reelection. Right now, we're in what could be described as a more sweet spot for Republicans because they have the majority in the House and the Senate. They have the White House. And right now they're moving in tandem. That may not happen next year. It also may not happen for the Democrats. So things get a little bit more messy during a midterm year. This is not that. The question is for both of these parties, what is their political calculation? If they do shut the government down, do they believe that they win the narrative with the American people? Are they the ones that get to say, look, it's the other guy and the American people believe that and blame the other party? And it hurts them so much that they come back to the negotiating table. You know, we'll see. This is politics of politics at play. And that's what we're going to be watching in Washington, D.C. this week. The big announcement last week I want to touch on real briefly was this announcement from the FDA. Before President Trump left and spoke in front of the United Nations, there was an announcement about autism. Remember, Secretary Kennedy promised this. He said that there was going to be some sort of answer about autism by September. And so we were getting close to the end of the month. And this announcement was twofold. There was an announcement about a concern from the FDA and others about an association between acetaminophen use, Tylenol use, and autism, the prevalence of autism. It was an association, not a causation. I'm going to get back to that in a moment because it's really, really important. And then there was also the announcement of a new drug and new research funds that are going to be put towards autism through the National Institute of Health. So the new drug is a drug that is used for some cancer patients. It's been used for some time, and it's believed to potentially help those with autism, specifically those that are nonverbal, sort of unlock a key to allow them to show more progress. That's the most general way that I can put it. I hope you get more detail as soon as possible from an interview I did with Dr. Marty McCary. He's the head of the FDA. We sat down with him on Thursday. We didn't know this announcement was happening on Monday. We sat down with him on Thursday. We talked about it. We talked about what does this mean for American families? What about Tylenol? Like, should we all not be using it? It's going to be flu season. We're going to have colds. Like, does no one use Tylenol anymore? You better believe I asked that question. And he provided some answers and some insight into that. As he mentioned in his announcement on Monday, he's a new father as well for the first time. So he's approaching medicine now with a little bit different perspective as well. So I'm looking forward to you hearing a little bit from him directly on this because this announcement sparked a lot of controversy. And I just want to touch on this very briefly because it seems that this question of Tylenol and association with autism can get a little messy in your social media feeds or even just conversations among friends. The we learned a lot about association versus causation during the pandemic. You know, what is an association for someone that could get COVID versus someone that did not? And there were all sorts of things, a character of a person that was described that could be more vulnerable to COVID than somebody who did not. But it was hard to say one thing caused the other. And that's what you really want in science. And honestly, what you want in journalism is to be able to say, hey, what's up? This is causing that. So don't do that. That's not this, though. The question of an association between Tylenol and autism has dated back actually more than a decade, and it's been studied time and time again. There are those that believe the association is more like causation, that there's something that's happening with the use of acetaminophen at a certain time in pregnancy or with a child at a certain time with a certain disposition that could exacerbate some of the different elements that and variables that would come together that would make them more susceptible to autism. But the problem with association is it's just that. We can say there's an association between something, and it's both hard to prove and also hard to disprove. So let me give you an example. I could say that those that eat mustard have lower heart disease than those that eat ketchup. And you could, can't we see a headline like that, by the way, coming up on the morning news program somewhere? And then you're going to have someone that shows you 10 different types of mustard. By the way, big mustard fans in my household. So this is why I'm using this. Okay. If you use mustard versus ketchup, guess what? Lower heart disease. So the question would be, if there's an association, is that because of an ingredient in mustard? Is that because there's no, you know, corn syrup like there is in ketchup? Or is it because that the people that eat ketchup are more likely to eat hamburgers and french fries, but mustard would be turkey sandwiches? You see what I'm saying? Like, I can't necessarily disprove that mustard isn't an association with lower heart disease, but it may not matter at all, because the real thing that's the issue for heart disease is diet. You see how that goes? And that's where this whole situation with Tylenol sort of exists in the scientific realm. I will share a little bit from that interview. I don't want to get ahead of the FDA commissioner because I really want you to hear from him. If you read the FDA's announcement that they gave to physicians, it's a lot more cautious than what was said at the podium on Monday. It's very much acknowledges there's different thinking on this, but also says, hey, we're looking at this. This has been around for some time, and we know there's different schools of thought, but we're going to flag this. And by the way, we're going to put a warning on Tylenol. So that's where it sits today. The question of whether or not you change your practice with that medicine, unfortunately, I know this sounds like a cop-out, but really does seem to sit with the individual and your healthcare professional. I know when they're like, talk to your doctor about it. You're like, that's why I'm listening to a podcast, is I'd like some more definitive answers on that, please and thank you. I felt the same way. I think that is hard when you hear this association and you think, well, should I just throw out all my ketchup then? Maybe I should just have mustard. No, by the way, that was a fake study that I just made up in my head, although sort of interesting, right? So that's how associations can happen. We want to acknowledge them, but we don't want to go too far down the road without some more information. So more on this interview as we get it. The real focus of it, and what I believe is the big story for the FDA right now, is actually about women's health. And it's because the FDA has been extremely focused on hormone replacement therapy and what that could mean for women, but more broadly, the country. And that's a bulk of our interviews is on that. So we're going to share that with you again ASAP. One other big news item that happened last week came from the Department of Justice. And I want to share this with you as well. We got news of something that has been talked about for some time, which is the indictment by the Justice Department of the former FBI Director James Comey. So I just want to touch on this really briefly. There's a couple things that are very important with this story. One of the most important things that's getting lost a little bit is the date. So there are parts about this indictment that are very nonspecific. There's a brevity to this indictment. It doesn't have a lot of information for us. We think this indictment is related to testimony that James Comey gave on September 30th, 2020. And the reason why that date matters is that there is a statute of limitations. The Justice Department had until September 30th, 2025, so Tuesday, to file charges. Otherwise, the statute of limitations would expire and there was no way to bring charges. That is something important that's getting lost in the news. Second thing that's getting lost in the news is, yes, this is the Trump administration, Justice Department, with these specific charges. However, it is charges that went before the grand jury. So it's not just the Justice Department unilaterally saying, we're going to go after this guy. It is true. They are saying we're going to go after this guy, but they have to go through a grand jury. A grand jury is a really important backstop in the American judicial system to keep that from just somebody charging anybody with a crime. So a grand jury is a jury of our peers to varying degrees. It could be, you know, to a dozen to half dozen people that sit on this grand jury, and prosecutors have to give them the case and say, this is what we would like to charge this person with. And the grand jury has the power to indict. And so it is both accurate to say the Department of Justice is behind these charges, absolutely, but also a jury of our peers, American citizens, saw this and said, okay, there's enough to pursue a case here. We don't know exactly what the third charge was. There's two different charges that are punishable by 5 years of prison. One is false statements, knowingly making a materially false statement. Another is obstruction, intentionally obstructing a civil investigation by making a false statement. Again, specifically what statement, we don't know in this indictment. And to talk about the importance of the grand jury, there is, and what you're seeing on your screen here, there was a third charge that the grand jury said, we're not voting to let that charge go through. We don't think that has enough to actually charge somebody with. We didn't see the evidence for that, so we're not doing that. So two charges, they did feel that way. One charge, they did not. And now this will proceed to eventually a trial. Obviously, there's questions of politics here, political targeting, and I want to recognize that. The Justice Department has talked about, you know, no one is above the law, suggesting that this is a charge brought because of actual false statements. James Comey came out and said he did nothing wrong, and he's willing to go to trial because he didn't. The details of this prosecution are really going to matter. And although the press is talking about it, like we all know what it is, going way back to 2020, the specific things that were said, we're really going to need to see the Justice Department's case on this to understand, well, how strong is this case or not? Something else that happened real quick last week that I want to mention to you is also percolating on Capitol Hill, and that is a meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu from Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu gave an address at the United Nations on Friday. A whole group of delegates walked out as soon as he started speaking. Dozens and dozens and dozens of people waited until he started, and then they all left as a show of protest against Israel's actions in Gaza. Prime Minister Netanyahu obviously has a difference of opinion, and he did something unusual at the UN. In case you missed it, I wanted to play this for you.
I want to do something I've never done before. I want to speak from this forum directly to those hostages through loudspeakers. I've surrounded Gaza with massive loudspeakers connected to this microphone in the hope that our dear hostages will hear my message. Our brave heroes, this is Prime Minister Netanyahu speaking to you live from the United Nations. We have not forgotten you, not even for a second. The people of Israel are with you. We will not falter, and we will not rest until we bring all of you home. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks to special efforts by Israeli intelligence, my words are now also being carried. They're streamed live to the cell phones of Gazans. So to the remaining Hamas leaders and to the jailers of our hostages, I now say, lay down your arms. Let my people go. Free the hostages, all of them. The whole 48, free the hostages now. If you do, you will live. If you don't, Israel will hunt you down. Ladies and gentlemen, if Hamas agrees to our demands, the war could end right now.
So Natalia was asking, President Trump mentioned the other day about a Gaza deal. What was that about? That's a great question, Natalia. No one knows specifically. We heard from Vice President Vance in the interview that I played for you regarding the government shutdown, that his thinking of what was transpiring behind the scenes was the closest that all sides have been to a deal, but that the deal has often broken apart in the last few minutes. So he doesn't count anything done until it's actually done. The reason why I chose this soundbite is a question about whether or not we could see an announcement about hostages, and if that was the key to some sort of deal coming together at the last minute. As we're coming up on the anniversary, I hate to say that word anniversary because it connotes something happy, as we're marking another year of the October 7th terrorist attack that started the latest war between Israel and Hamas, sometimes there's gained momentum around those historic days as a way that there's like a poetic ending. And that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Like, who's paying attention to that? Well, let me just flag for you, the withdrawal from Afghanistan by the Biden administration was geared right around the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of September 11th. So there are ways that administrations and people in power try to use the momentum around a certain date to push forward or allow for an opening where maybe there wouldn't otherwise be. I don't know if that's the case here, but it's one of the reasons why we're going to watch it this week and over the next week to see, is there actual movement? And we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu and the president are at the White House right now speaking behind closed doors. So let's see if we hear anything. I just want to flag this. We're not going to go super deep in it, but we did see the president speak with the Ukrainian president at the United Nations and was a far more friendly, supportive conversation than it's been in the past. We're continuing to see reports of Russian drones flying into the airspace of different NATO countries. We're continuing to see those reports. So this is a very big story. Last week, we saw fighter jets fly from Russia into our airspace in Alaska, this sort of open airspace right outside our country. So this provocative action from Russia is continuing. The United States has started to defer more to Ukraine. This is another story that we want to keep an eye on. So wanted to make sure just to put that on your radar real quick. All right, as we finish up here, I actually have a little bit of a treat for you that I wanted to play for you, and I wasn't quite sure how to do it. But I know so many of you are frustrated with what you're hearing in politics. You know, whether it's the government shutdown or the right way to move forward in the Middle East or healthcare or all of it, it can seem so tense. It's no longer enjoyable to learn about because the tension is so pervasive. It almost ruins the conversation. And you may have seen the Utah governor, Spencer Cox, speak related to the murder of Charlie Kirk. And he had a lot of things to say on a national stage, really for the first time, speaking about politics in America in a way that resonated with a lot of Americans outside of Utah. And so he did an interview with 60 Minutes over the weekend. And part of that interview, he talks about a group that he's really been trailblazing. And it started off as part of the National Governors Association, but it's spun off and it's called Disagree Better. And basically this is a platform of events and a different kind of curriculum around how to have political discourse in the United States. And that might sound kind of like, okay, here's another group, you know, talking about how we need to be nicer to each other. But it was seeing the governors in action from different political backgrounds that I thought you would enjoy. So this piece has Governor Cox of Utah and Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, a Democrat from New Mexico. Scott Pelley is the interviewer. And he asked a very key question at the beginning here about, wait a minute, if we're saying that we can talk to each other, does that mean that we basically have to meet in the middle somewhere? And this goes back to our conversation a couple weeks ago about how the center needs to be stronger and more provocative and more active and more dynamic. So I want you to hear some believe that that's what needs to happen in American politics today to kind of cool the jets on everybody else. Here's this exchange. I thought you would enjoy it.
Does disagree better mean that we should drop our differences and everybody meets in the middle?
Absolutely not. In fact, it's the exact opposite of that. Abortion is an issue on which we disagree passionately. And yet, even though we have these very strong, it looks like a chasm between us, I think we would both agree that we should be doing more to take care of single moms. I think those are the types of things that that we can agree on while still being pretty passionate about whether we think abortion should be legal or not.
And when you do that, and we listen, and we find that there is some common ground, it reduces, right, lowers the temperature It provides opportunity, not just for discourse, but doing something.
Do governors understand something that Washington does not?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. We're completely about results, not about rhetoric.
We like to say that potholes aren't partisan, and governors do have to deliver actual results. I think there's sadly, in D.C., we've seen this performative politics and much less substance.
There are some people watching this interview who are disgusted that you two are sitting together.
Well, we need courage over comfort. You know, I don't work for a partisan party. I work for every single New Mexican.
Yeah, I see her as an American before I see her as a Democrat or anything else. I think we need more of these conversations. I think we need them in our own homes, in our own neighborhoods, in our school boards, in our city councils, all across the country.
What do you guys think? Courage over comfort? I like that. It feels like it has a ring. It's like curiosity over commentary. Courage over comfort. And also that they recognize they're not going to agree on everything, but they could just disagree better. Seems like a good place to start. That question from Scott Pelley of like, there are people that just hate you guys sitting together. I actually thought about that. I thought, is that really true? And this is something you actually have to avoid as a journalist. First of all, I'll leave that to you. Is that true? Do you think people are just disgusted looking at the two of them sitting next to each other? I mean, maybe, I guess. But one of the things I was very worried about when I interviewed the FDA commissioner is that when you are in front of people sometimes as an interviewer, you can summarize your experience. So I could, if I do that though, I want to ground it in something. You know, people at Smarter News have this reaction to this. Then it's not just me kind of making something up, because there's a lot of talk about how divisive America is, but I think a lot of you probably have friends that have different points of view that you still really like, and like family that you still really like, and you don't hate them. There are some people that do that. But the more we talk about everybody like that, I wonder if that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's really important when I hear questions like that, it would be different if he cited a poll or like cited a direct quote from someone. I thought, I wonder if our audience believes the same thing. There are people that would hate you two sitting next to each other. I'm like, they look pretty comfortable. I think they're probably fine. I don't know if anyone really has that strong of a feeling about it, but maybe. So that could be an organization you can look into. I thought this could be an interesting organization too for Smarter News, as we like to talk to everyone from different political backgrounds and perspectives. So just a little news you could use as we end another broadcast that has a lot of tough news in it. And I appreciate your patience and your questions with that. A couple quick questions for this. Tracy, I just want to go back to Tracy's question about, did a grand jury indict Trump for all the legal stuff? The answer, the short answer is yes. Tracy, there was a grand jury for a couple of these cases that President Trump faced that indicted him on these charges, which is what the argument was about it, these charges not being politically motivated, that, okay, they originated in a Justice Department under Biden, but it's a jury of his peers that believed that he should go to court and face these charges. So you're seeing the same argument here for James Comey. I'll leave it to you to kind of feel out what you think about that. Amy had a question about the shooter, specifically the one in Michigan. We've seen a variety of different shootings, and she was asking the question about connection to ex-military. Just a word of wisdom here in years of covering any of these awful cases where a veteran may be involved. And probably just admittedly a little sensitivity to this because I am married to a veteran and military families are so few that I realize now how much that affected my journalism when I didn't have that experience. I just didn't have life experience with it. The one thing I will say is that the press is very quick, if someone had any past service, to say it's PTSD, there's trauma in their service. This is another veteran who went crazy because of what they were asked to do overseas. That is always a potential that PTSD can play a role in a variety of different crimes that a veteran could or cannot commit. However, just because someone served doesn't mean that they were in a traumatic event or experienced combat. And sometimes the image of that is kind of automatically associated in the press. And I think we have to be really careful about that. So as we get more information about the shooter and what exactly his service was, that would be an interesting question, which is, you know, what did he experience PTSD? Was there an injury that happened while he was serving? You don't have to be in combat for an injury. We've seen that over the years, for sure. Training can be really, really dangerous too. So just to not overly generalize the military, and by the way, Amy, I don't think you're doing that. I just wanted to kind of equip you with that. Really get specific. Okay, if someone is a former Marine, but what does that mean? Not all Marines have done the same thing. We want to be more specific to understand how is that directly related to this particular crime. So more on that as we get it. By the way, quick announcement here. Did you see that Starbucks is trying to go through a pretty serious business edit, shutting down potentially a few stores? They're trying to get more friendly in their shops. You know, when you walk into Starbucks now, someone's supposed to say hello. sounds pretty basic, but that's what they're trying to make more uniform. But today's the day that they are unleashing their protein coffee drinks. So you can get them. I actually had it pulled up. You can get like a protein foam. I mean, protein matcha. This isn't an ad. We're not sponsored by Starbucks. Maybe we should be. New protein lattes. So we know protein is real hot. And apparently this is going to be offered in stores. And a ready-to-drink version will be available next year. So if you're feeling light on your protein today, do some reporting on behalf of Smarter News. Go buy yourself a protein coffee. And let me report back. Let me know what you think about it. Is it worth it? Did I get a little protein cream? I mean, if you're going to get cream, a little protein? I mean, let's try it. All right. Okay, guys, thank you so much for your support. Quick, concise, nonpartisan news. We're working really hard behind the scenes to get that interview out for you with the FDA commissioner. And I really look forward to your feedback on that. So more news as we get it throughout the week. And thank you for your support of a free and independent press. Have a great one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.